I'm coming down this hill, and I get pulled over, and the cop comes up, and he says, you know why I pulled you over? And he said, no, sir. He said, well, let me see your driver's license. Let me see your registration. So I'm getting that stuff out. And he said, you know, I pulled you over because you were speeding. He said, you were doing 48 and a 35. And Debbie says, he's always speeding on these rural roads. And so I give him my registration and license, and he said, I'm also going to give you a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt. I said, well, I was wearing my seatbelt, but I knew you would be asking for my wallet, so I... She said, he's lying. He never wears a seatbelt. I looked over at her and I said, would you shut up? And the guy said, a cop sticks his head in the window and says, does he always talk to you? She said, only when he's drinking. Let's show Chris a warm Gulf Coast welcome. Shake, Chris.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. You know, it's really wonderful. What a great place to have a conference. You know, I've been in some places that were not this nice, let me tell you. And it's nice to be back in Florida again. I've had my issues with Florida. Back in the late 70s, I lived in Florida for a while, and it took me about 3 years to make all the amends when I finally got sober for what happened to me in Florida. I remember this one. Well, I don't really remember this one time because I was in a blackout, but this is what happened. I allowed myself to be overserved. You know how that is. And I drove up on this guy's lawn in my car, and he was one of those people that cares about their lawns. You know, you'll see him out there like pulling the dandelions and, you know, cutting the rose bushes. I had the kind of yard that had like refrigerators in it and big tall weeds. You know, so I wasn't too happy about this, but I drove up on his yard and I ran over one of his palmetto trees. It's like a 20-foot high tree. And it got stuck under my car, and I kept going. I, like, ripped the tree right out of his front yard and kept going. Well, he was annoyed, so he called the police, and the police found me about 20 blocks later down the road asleep, you know, snoring, with the tree still stuck under my car. And these kind of things were always happening to me down here. I actually came down to Florida to go to college. I spent 4.5 years. I got 6 credits. Okay, that's like, I mean, that's almost impossible to do, but I did. Anyway, I said that I'm an alcoholic. I don't believe I became alcoholic because I drank. I believe I drank because I was an alcoholic, and I want to explain that. And I have to start at the beginning for this. I was doing an inventory one time, and the instruction was, I was doing a fear inventory from the 4-step, and the instruction was, go back to your absolute earliest fear. This is what I was told to do in this exercise about the different things. And I came across fear of people, you know, anxiety of social situations, things like that. And I went back and I tried to remember my earliest recollection of that fear. And it was the first day I went to kindergarten. I remember, you know, my mother coming to me and saying, get dressed. This is your first day at kindergarten. And I didn't really know what that meant too much. So she put me in the car, drove me across town. And I remember she stopped at the top of this hill, and the school was down at the bottom of the hill. And she opened up the door and she said, have a nice day. And I remember getting out of the car and standing on the hill and looking down at the school, and the kids are outside. They're playing kickball and tag. It's like they've already become really good friends. And I'm standing up there on the hill going, whose idea was this? I'm not going to be able to do this. This is too traumatic. You know, what if I say something stupid? What if they don't like me? I was filled with that self-centered fear. And that was the first time I can remember just sucking it up and acting as if I wasn't boiling over emotionally inside. And I went down there and I did the kindergarten thing. Now, you know what would have really helped that situation? A half a pint of vodka. You know what I mean? I'd have gone down there. I'd have been the kindergarten kid on a half a pint of vodka. But the problem was they weren't serving five-year-olds at that point in time. And that became a big problem for me. Because I believe what I was suffering from was alcoholism. You know, I mean, I just was totally uncomfortable with myself, my environment. I was always projecting the absolute worst and, you know, feeling guilt and remorse about the past. I was like overburdened. They talk about the bondage of self in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suffered from this at all kinds of emotional levels. Now, you know, I went through school always acting as if, you know, I didn't have unbelievable anxiety. I'm about 12, and me and a couple of my friends decide we're going to cut school. We're going to go back to my house, and we're going to get drunk. This sounded like a really cool thing to do, and we did that. We cut school. I didn't know anything about drinking at this point in time. I don't come from an alcoholic household, really. There wasn't a lot of drinking. There was, you know, a couple of beers here and there, a whiskey sour every once in a while. So, I mean, I didn't have any perspective on this. But I knew it would be cool to go back to school the next day and tell everybody that, you know, we went and got drunk. So that's what we did. We went back to my house. I pulled out a bottle of Four Roses whiskey, and I poured three big water glasses of warm Four Roses whiskey. Didn't let it breathe, you know, didn't add ice. Just, I didn't know any better, right? And the two guys, I want to tell you about the two guys that I was drinking with, because this is significant, at least for me. They never became alcoholic, they never became problem drinkers. You know what they did? They drank two-thirds of their glass, and they had enough. You ever ever drink with people that had enough on you? You know what I mean? Is that disconcerting or what? What do you mean you've had enough? It's only 11 o'clock. Let's go to the city. You know, I mean, that's how I drank. So they had enough and they sat back and they watched the show. Because here's what I did. I drank my glass. I drank the rest of their glasses. I finished up the bottle. And I went into the very first blackout I ever had. I'm 12 years old. I'm a blackout drinker already. Any blackout drinkers in here? That's another thing that's disconcerting, isn't it? How do you know you don't have any I nevers? You know? So I go into this blackout. I wake up in a field having all this missing time. And, you know, I had bruises and bumps. I'd trashed the house. I'd fallen downstairs. I was in rough shape. And then I started to get that nuclear hangover. You know, that first drunk hangover that you get where you have to stay horizontal for 2 days. You're so sick. And I started to get really, really sick. Now, here's the thing. If I would have had any other type of food or beverage and gotten that sick, I never would have touched it again. Like if it was a rutabaga that would have made me that sick or something, you know, I wouldn't have had to go to like Rutabagas Anonymous and get a rutabaga non-eaten sponsor, you know, and get other phone numbers of other non-rutabaga eaters. I mean, I wouldn't have to go through that because I would have had, you know, a defense. But here's the thing, you know, that scared kindergartner that I was talking about earlier, when I started drinking that Four Roses whiskey, that got rid of the fear. It took the fear right out of me. I felt larger than life. I was the funniest guy. You know, I always was really self-centered, you know, always kind of afraid to like talk to the women and stuff. You know, I'd drink enough of this booze and you'd be lucky if I come over and talk to you. You know, it was like just a complete shift in perception that I had with this booze. So what happened to me, what I believe happened to me, and you learn so much in hindsight, like when you're looking back on your life, you really can get a better picture than when you're in the middle of it. What I believe happened was because that was the answer to like my emotional instability, I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. Now, I didn't drink Four Roses ever again. If I smelled it today, I probably would be sick. But I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. I started to drink the kid-type drinks, the Boone's Farm apple wine, you know, the things that you drink when you're 12. And I started to get real preoccupied, and, you know, who's going to buy it? Where are we going to drink? Out in the woods at the fort, you know, all this stuff. And I didn't recognize it at this point in time, but alcohol very quickly started to take over the planning of my life. I started to become very, very dependent on that alcohol, and so I would arrange the stuff in my life to accommodate the drinking. Now, I come from a very smart family. My brother and sister are both PhD college professors. My mother and father were Phi Beta Kappa. Just an incredibly intelligent family. Very little common sense, but really, really well learned. And you know, I come from that stock. Well, by the time I got to senior year in high school, I graduated the second stupidest person in the whole high school. You know, it was like a 2.0001 average, you know, just enough to get me out. And I recognize looking back on it that I shoved a lot of the things out of the way to make room for the alcohol. Now, you don't think about this at the time. You don't say to yourself, you know, I'm becoming preoccupied with alcohol. If I keep on like this, my grades will slip and I may not get into the college of my choice. I mean, that's not what you say. You say, who cares? Get off my back. Leave me alone. I'm not bothering anybody at all. You know, this is my business. The war cry of the alcoholic. So, you know, I started to get into trouble with drinking because I was a blackout drinker. And I did things like drive all the time. You know, I had some problems. I crashed 9 cars in drunken blackouts. I was always okay while I was conscious, but I would drop out of consciousness while I was driving, which is a bad thing. You know, the first bad accident I got into, I was actually killed. When the cops got there, they had to give me CPR because I had no pulse and I wasn't breathing. And they revived me. And on the way to the hospital in the ambulance, I went flatline again, you know, and they hit me with the Hooters and, you know, like snapped me out of it. And I'll tell you, you would think that something that unbelievably disastrous would get your attention. Okay, the minute I was out of the hospital, the first thing I did was go to the liquor store and drive down to the park and start drinking. Because, you know, it wasn't like, nothing like that computes. You know, I mean, common sense is just not accessible to the alcoholic at certain times. I had so many DWIs. I finally got to the point where I said, you know, I've got to stop driving. You know, I mean, you know, you're not gonna stop me from drinking. So I'm going through. I get out of high school, and you know, I'm bumming around, and the high school parties were really cool. They were a lot of fun to go to. You know. Like, you know, rock band would be on, there'd be a fight, you know, everybody'd be there, you'd just be having fun, and it was just really great. But 2 or 3 years outside of high school, I'm still looking for that type of party. It talks in our book that we're trying to relive, re-experience that conviviality, that party atmosphere that we had years ago, but it's slipped out of our hands. And that's really what happened to me. And, you know, I started to drink very, very dangerously, you know. A lot of other things were going on. This is the early 70s. So there was a lot of non-conference approved substances out there that, you know, you could get your hands on. And, you know, I partook of them. You know, I was non-discriminatory. I used everything I could alcoholically. And, you know, I'd get myself in trouble a lot of times with these things. I remember the Quaalude epidemic of 72. Okay? Now, this was caused, if anybody doesn't know what Quaaludes are, I'll explain really quickly, because you take a Quaalude and it's like drinking a tall pack of malt liquor in 5 minutes. You know, that's what it's like. You just, whoa. And what happened was a friend of mine showed up at school with a big bag of Quaaludes that he'd gotten from his brother the night before. He'd never had them before. You know, go sell these at school. So we all would hang around the smoking area in school and, you know, we'd do whatever we could do. And he comes in and he goes, I got Quaaludes. And everybody runs up to him. How much? You know, what do they do? And how many do you take? I remember asking the guy. He goes, three or four. Oh, man. So first period, I take three Quaaludes. Okay? The last thing I remember is walking down the hallway, like hanging onto the lockers like this. And I think to myself, I got to get out of here. This is really bad. I mean, the ambulance is back and forth because like 50 people ate like three or four Quaaludes. So I go, I know, I'll make a break. I'll make a break for it. I saw the exit sign, right? So I break through the exit door and I head for the woods. But what I don't realize is the whole entire 400 wing is like facing where I'm headed. And the next day they come up and say, Chris, that was beautiful yesterday, you know, watching you head for the woods. It took you 5 minutes to go 100 yards, you know. I thought I was moving, you know. Oh. But, you know, time and time again, I would get in trouble with this stuff. A lot of times, you know, listen, this is an AA conference, and I've got to tell you, alcohol was first and it was last. It was what really got me. I don't really even identify myself as a drug addict, because when it was time to move away from that stuff, I just moved away from it. I didn't have to go to, you know, 17 different 12-step programs. I had the power of choice with that stuff. But alcohol had me. But the problem was when you're drunk, you'll do just about anything. And, you know, another time I'm in New York City at a concert, and, you know, they're passing around LSD. So I take a whole bunch of it. You know, I'm not even paying attention. All of a sudden on the way home, you know, we all pile into the van and start heading from New York City down to the Lincoln Tunnel. Now it's like six lanes, four lanes, two lanes, and then you go into the tunnel, okay? Well, we're heading down to the tunnel, and somebody in the van goes, hey, man, we'll never fit, you know? And so we all start moving to the front of the van, and we're all looking, you know? He's right, you know? It took us 45 minutes to back up and back out of it. You know, we had to take the bridge. Oh man. Just, you know, one debacle after another. Now I'm going to tell you my first DUI, I'm going to tell you my last DUI, and then hopefully we'll move a little bit into the recovery part of tonight. My first DUI, again, I allowed myself to be overserved. I remember being at this bar, chugging pitchers of beer. Now that's social drinking for you, huh? You know, like chug a pitcher of beer. I mean, I was limber, you know. And I remember getting out into the car. The person who was supposed to be my designated driver disappeared, you know, or I pissed him off or something, you know. And so I'm driving and I hit some black ice. It's the middle of winter in New Jersey, and the car spins around backwards and hits a bridge abutment, and I get thrown out the back window. Okay, I remember I'm laying on the trunk. My legs are still in the car. And I'm looking up at the stars going, whoa, you know, this been good. But the car is still running. Now, it's got three flat tires. It's bent like a boomerang. There's not a window left in the car. It's the middle of winter. The drive shaft is slapping the frame. The headlights are pointing like this. What do you do, though? You got to go home, right? You know? So I start driving home. I'm going whack-a-da-boo-ga-da-bam, whack-a-da-boo-ga-da-bam, about 2 miles an hour. Well, I drive by a cop given radar. You know, he's like, and he doesn't even pull me over. He walks me over. You know what I mean? I I remember he's leaning into the window and he starts shaking me. Where'd you have that accident? And I'm like, what accident? There's glass flying out of my hair. Oh, man. DUI number one. Now, many years later, one more time, overserved, you know, and I'm driving home, and supposedly I crossed the double yellow. You know how cops are, okay? Supposedly. Now, the cop knocks on the window. I roll the window down. And he goes, license, registration, insurance card. So I'm reaching into the glove compartment, and I am trashed, okay? Sometimes you just don't know how drunk you are, and that's, you know, that's the grace of God sometimes. But anyway, I'm fumbling in this glove compartment, and I'm having a time, you know? So finally I get frustrated. I just hand the entire contents of the glove compartment to the cop. There's maps and pens and hairbrushes and everything. Now, you know how cops are, you know, out of the car. You know, so. Now, do you remember hazy recollections? It talks about hazy recollections in the big book. You remember little bits and pieces, but you can't really put the whole puzzle together. Well, I remember being taken to the police station, and about the only thing I can remember is I nailed the ABCs in the test, okay? I adamantly refused to take a breathalyzer. I'm not drunk. I'm not taking any breathalyzer. So they gave me this test. And back then, they probably still do it. They filmed me. Now, I nailed the ABCs. I was sure of this, so I hired an attorney. You know, we're gonna set right this injustice. And I get this $1,500 attorney, and the first thing you do is go up to the police station and view the video. Has anybody ever seen their DUI video? Just do a pass on that, you know, okay? Because it's really disturbing. Now, I remember doing pretty well with the ABCs. I'm sitting there with my attorney, and the cop, as he comes in to hand us the VHS tape, sniggers. He's like, like this, you know? And that's not a good sign. So, my lawyer puts it into the TV and presses play, and I'm horrified. I am so drunk, I don't even know how I'm still conscious. They've got the video of me hanging onto the wall, hanging onto the cop while I'm walking the line, you know? I mean, it was just really, really bad. And it gets to the, and me, this $1,500 lawyer's taking notes, he's very serious. It gets to the ABCs, and I nailed the ABCs, I nailed them like this. Can I have a cigarette? Oh, it was horrible. Now, I'm like cringing up, and you know the lawyer's still taking notes and everything. Now, at the very end of this nightmare, the cop says, "We're about to turn off the video. Do you have anything to add before we turn it off?" I look over at the camera and I go, "No!" Like I said, I'm like. The lawyer just breaks out. He's like, "Bah! I've never seen anything like that. But, oh, I can't believe you ever that stupid. Oh, if you had any chance at all, you just blew it. Bah!" I'm like, I guess we'll plead, you know. Oh man. I walked for 4 years, you know, that really puts a dent in your dating life, you know what I mean? You know, yeah, the Mercedes in the shop, you know, I mean, it's very, very difficult to pull off. Oh, God. You know, so my life is going down, down, down. I actually met, in high school, I knew this girl, and after high school, we kind of hooked up. Now, I'm looking back on it, and basically what it was she came from an alcoholic family. Both of her mother and father died of alcoholism. Three brothers died of alcoholism. I mean, you know, this is an Irish alcoholic family. And she latched onto me like I was home, you know what I mean? And the relationship worked for me because she thought about me as much as I did, you know? So it was working, but we ended up getting married, you know, moving down to Florida, you know, I was going to go to school. And it became a nightmare, stand up. I couldn't do the things that you need to do to provide for a family. I couldn't provide emotional support. I couldn't provide financial support. You know, I would find, suggestions and her requirements, you know, untenable. Like, what do you mean you want me to put insurance on the car? You know, what do you mean I gotta get a job? You know, I mean, all these things, I couldn't do it because I was incapable of like dealing with the world. If I wasn't really drunk, I wasn't comfortable. It was like alien territory to me. You know, so what happened is it got to the point where she just couldn't take it anymore and she left. And, you know, I remember it like it was yesterday. She gave me 30 minutes notice, packed up the our daughter, the dog, emptied the bank account, took the car and split. And I remember thinking, you know, I just can't believe she left me when I needed her most. You know? Now, many years later, doing inventory, I come to the truth that she would have been crazy to stay. You know, that's what's very, very helpful about the self-examination that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our perspective is wrong. Our perception is wrong. We see the world wrong as alcoholics. We have to shift our perception. We have to shift our perspective to accommodate the alcohol. And that makes everything really unreal. And what I did for the next year is I drank with a vengeance, you know, because she left me. You know, she left me. And that gave me a real reason to drink. Now, I'd gotten in some trouble in Florida. Again, this took me like 3 years to make amends for. The cops were looking for me. They're bill collectors. I was supposed to do community service. You know, the whole thing happens. And it's just really hard to, like, do that stuff. You know, it's like inconvenient and everything else. So all this, my world was like closing in on me. And what do you do if you're like, you know, a macho guy? You find out if mom needs some help around the house is what you do. And that's what I did. You know, I moved back to New Jersey and I was only going to stay for a little while. I stayed for the last 6 years of my drinking. You know, burn her house down twice. It was a mess. And, you know, to this day, I'm making up for that. But it got to the point, and I became an electrician somehow. I don't know how this happened. Somebody was reading an Esquire magazine, and they said, you know, MBAs are going to be making the same as electricians, it says here, in 10 years. Okay, you know, so I went off to become an electrician. Now, it's a really bad trade to be in when you shake like this in the morning. I was constantly blowing things up and causing trouble. I'll just give you a couple of snippets. There was this one time where I was working with this guy, and he really hated me because I just wasn't pulling my weight, you know, and I was always sick and all this stuff. And this one time, we're working together on a house, and we're putting in a new electrical service. And I'm putting the meter up on the side of the house, and he's messing around in the truck getting some supplies. And I had gotten really drunk the night before and used some special effects with that alcohol. And it was really bad. And I was dehydrated that morning. You remember how dehydrated you used to get? You'd have to drink like a half a gallon of liquid to like hydrate back up. Well, I had picked a half a gallon of grape drink that morning, and I drank that. And all of a sudden, I'm standing there putting the meter up on the side of the house. And now I know I've got like 7.3 seconds to get somewhere, okay? Because I don't want this guy to see me vomiting. You know, he already thinks I'm lame. So I go, I know what I'll do. I'll tear around the back of the house. So that's what I do. I move really quick, and I just get around to the back of the house, and whoa! Like a fire hydrant, okay? I stucco this house with purple vomit. Just whoa! Like the whole half gallon came out in like 1 second. And I thought I was alone, okay? There's an adjoining deck to the back of this house, and there's a family, a mother, a father, and three kids having iced tea like 10 feet away from me, you know? And they all had the same expression on their face. They're like, you know, mommy, mommy, the purple puke monster from hell, mommy, you know? Now, you don't want to look stupid, you know? So, you know how this, so I'm hosing off the house. Yeah, it's a condition, you know? Oh, God. Yeah, another time. Now, this sounds so bizarre, you wouldn't even think it was true, but I swear this is true. I'm working in a department store as a maintenance electrician, you know, because I lost my license. I had to get, like, a stationary job. And this is when computer cash registers came in. And I had to daisy chain all the computer wires to the cash registers. That was my job. So I would have to, there'd be desks in the middle of the floor. So you'd have to drill through the floor, climb into the ceiling, find the wire. It took me like 2 months to do this whole building. But what I've got is I've got a big, huge drill. Those old big silver drills with like the rebar handles and the locking trigger. Remember those? They're like 600 RPM and like 12 horsepower. You know, the most dangerous things you've ever seen. And it's got a big auger bit with a big extension. Now, I'm working in the lingerie section of this department store. And I'm kind of distracted a little bit. You know, And I'm drilling, you know, and all of a sudden the thing catches a beam and the trigger locks. So like I bear down on this drill and what it did was it twisted me around like this. It twisted me up in the cord and then ripped the pants off my ass. Okay? It finally unplugs from the wall and I'm hanging there like this on the drill, all bloodied up with no pants. And you don't want to look stupid. You know, happens all the time with this drill, you know. But things like this were happening to me on a continuous basis. It would get anyone's attention unless you were an alcoholic. Now, finally it got to the point, this is the straw that broke the camel's back. What happened was, one day I was trying to put a ground screw in a ceiling fixture box. And I was shaking so bad, the screw was coming off the end of the screwdriver. And the guy who was in charge of me, who was 19, by the way, that's how much faith my boss had in me, you know, I'm 33, you know, he's looking at me, and you know, when you're alcoholic, you can hear people thinking at you, you know what I mean? And he's thinking, yeah, what a loser, you know, what, that guy can't even hold a screw, you know? And he was just looking at me, and that just did something to me. Now, I'd lost my license 3 times. I'd crashed all these cars. My family deserted me. All of my friends are gone. But that look that guy gave me, that look of you are just so pathetic, was enough for me to go back home that day and call up the treatment center. I'd been through outpatient to get my license back, so I knew there was a treatment center for alcoholism. So I called them up and I said, I'm coming in, you know, and they're like, well, who are you, first of all, you know, not too grandiose, you know, they're waiting for me, you know, and I go in there and I do the 28 days, okay, I do the 28 days. Now, I used to think this is a pretty good treatment center. I don't anymore because I'm involved in treatment for a profession. I work for a company that supports treatment and tries to, you know, help show best practices and, you know, help support them in different ways. And I really know what works and what doesn't work today. But I went to this 28-day treatment center, and really all they did was, I never even had one one-on-one with a counselor. Now, all they had was group. You ever do group? Where you sit around in a circle and everybody goes, well, you think my day was horrible. You wouldn't believe my day. And, you know, the next one, well, you think your day is bad. You're, oh, man, my day was much worse than yours. And I'm sitting in this group going, shut up. Will you just shut up? I want to share. You know, it was, listen, trying to treat alcoholism with group is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? It's just, it ain't going to happen. So I did like 400 groups, and then they let me out. Now, you got to understand, I really, really wanted to stay separated from alcohol. It had really gotten me down. I knew I was literally poisoning my body every night with it. I was a blackout, everyday blackout drinker. I'd start drinking at 4. I'd be drunk out of my mind at 6. I'd be in a blackout at 8, and I'd be passed out on the floor at 8:30. I mean, that was my drinking pattern. And you do this day after day after day, and your body just starts to shut down. And that's what was happening to me. So I really, really wanted to stay separated from booze. Now, I get out of the treatment center, and they say, you should go to AA. So, okay, I'll go to AA. You should go to outpatient. Okay, I'll go to outpatient. I mean, I'm doing all these things that I didn't want to do. You got to understand, I didn't want to go to AA. Oh, my God, Alcoholics Anonymous? Are you kidding? In a church basement? Why don't you just kill me now, you know, and put me out of my misery? God, what if my friends see me? You know, I mean, you know, it was not what I wanted to do. Outpatient, to pay money. I was paying like $60 a night to hear some muttonhead talk for 45 minutes about, you know, how awful his girlfriend is or something. I mean, that's a waste of money. But I'm doing it because that's what they're telling me to do. So I'm desperate. I really, really, really want to separate from alcohol, and I'm willing to, like, ruin my life to do it and go to these things, okay? Now, I'm sober almost 90 days, and I'm driving to an AA meeting. Now, the thought crosses my mind. This is what I thought. You know, it's been almost 3 months since I've been drunk. I don't even know if I remember what it's like to be drunk. You know, I'll bet if I was to get drunk, it would help all this AA stuff. It'll like remind me, like, you know, why I'm here, and, you know, re-motivate me. It'll reinvigorate me. Okay? So I went and I bought a gallon of vodka and drank it to improve my sobriety. Only an alcoholic can come up with that one. But this is the thing. At certain times, you're not going to have an adequate mental defense against alcohol if you're an alcoholic prior to a spiritual experience. That's just true. Okay, and I was going to meetings, and I was going to outpatient. I was telling everybody I was in AA, and I was never drinking again, and I was doing all that stuff. But the thought crossed my mind that this would be a good idea. So I buy a gallon of vodka, and I start drinking it. I'm into my third drink, and all of a sudden, I go, oh, my God, what have I done? I've opened up the cage door of the beast. He's going to drag me around by the hair for whoever knows how long. Why? How did I let this happen? Now, here's the thing. Was I insane before I got drunk or after I got drunk? The alcohol actually restored me to some kind of sanity. Okay? Think about this. The most stupid things you've ever done in your life, you've done sober, taking the first drink. Every time you got drunk, you did it sober. You know what I'm saying? That's the problem with alcoholism. I can't just wish this stuff away. I can't just... In the beginning, I thought AA was like a big pep rally. Like, yay, yay, we don't drink today. You know what I mean? And we keep reminding each other to not drink. Like, just remember now, don't drink. I mean, that's what I thought it was. I thought it was like a big football huddle. Like, you know, everybody gets together. Okay, let's keep it simple. First things first. Easy does it. See you back here tomorrow. Okay, break. You know? I mean, I didn't understand it. I remember this guy came up to me when I was in early sobriety. And because I'm telling everybody I'm in AA. Listen, if you're new, don't tell people you're in AA. Okay? We need one more black eye if you don't make it. Like, we need a hole in the head. Anyway, I'm telling everybody I'm in AA. And this one guy comes up and he goes, well, what are those AA meetings like? And I said, well, you know, we go down into a church basement and, you know, we get a cup of coffee and then we sit down and we say a little prayer and then the meeting starts and somebody will have a resentment and they'll share a resentment and somebody else will share their resentment and, you know, and then an hour goes by and, you know, we all stand in a big circle and we hold hands and we say the Lord's Prayer. And by this time the guy's backing away from me, okay? And I'm thinking, he's right. That doesn't make any sense, you know? It doesn't make any sense. Now, what happened was I had a horrific relapse. That gallon of vodka led to like 7 months of drinking. And what happened was Christmas 1989 at my mother's house, you know, my brother, sister, home, nieces and nephews, you know, cats. It's Christmas time, so the Christmas tree's all decked out, and there's presents, and the Christmas carols are on, and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care, you know, and everybody's all, you know, family. And I start drinking Johnny Walker Black and go into a violent blackout where I'm going to kill all you! I'm going to kill you! You know, and so they all left, and, you know, they went and had Christmas somewhere else. Thank you. You know, and this was just an awful bender I was on. I remember coming out of this and like staggering into the kitchen, you know, for water or something, and seeing a pile of vodka bottles in the kitchen sink. I didn't even remember buying them. You know, it was like 15 quarts of vodka that I don't even remember drinking. And I started to go into the DTs. Anybody ever experienced the DTs in here? They're fun, aren't they? You're hallucinating and fish flopping, and you hear marching bands. You know what I mean? Oh, it's just really brutal. And anybody in their right mind would have called an ambulance, because you can die in these type of, you stroke out or your aorta bursts, and you know, there goes your warranty. But I didn't call an ambulance. You want to know why? I didn't want to look stupid. Imagine the ambulance drivers coming up and going, oh, what can we help you with? Well, I've been drinking too much. Oh, okay, so you're a loser. You know, I didn't want to go through that, so I took my chances on the floor for 4 days, fish flopping around. Now, when I got out of this, I was absolutely desperate. You know, Bill talked yesterday, and what a great talk. And he's the guy that's instrumental in that movie, My Name is Bill W. Let me tell you my story about this movie. I'd been to AA a little bit, and I understood that that's probably the only place that I have any hope. Okay, so during my detox for 4 days while I was hallucinating and fish flopping, I was watching My Name is Bill W. over and over again. I probably watched it 25 times while I was detoxing because I was hanging on to some kind of hope. Now, when I finally got to the point where I could move around, you know, I was feeling at least a little bit human, I'm looking in the meeting book, I've got to get to a meeting, I've got to get to a meeting, I've got to get back to AA. Now, I had one of those alcoholic cars, you know, like it was a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls, okay? It had no clutch, it had no muffler, no emergency brake. The heater core was gone, so if you turned on the heater, it would squirt antifreeze on the inside of the window. You know, it was just a piece of crap. All the quarter panels were destroyed, and there was orange paint inexplicably strewn around the interior of the car. Like somebody took a gallon of orange paint and just threw it everywhere. It was like awful. Now, I'm looking in the meeting book, and because it's got no clutch, I've got to find a flat meeting because I can't go up any hills. So I'm looking through the meeting book, there's a flat meeting in Morristown, you know. So I get in a car and, you know, I'm driving and I get to Morristown. Now there's a little hill where you have to go up into the parking lot, just a tiny little thing. And everybody, all 7,000 of them are outside smoking cigarettes on the porch, right? And I've got to gun this thing to get up this like 2-inch hill. So I go, wah! Like this, about 2 miles an hour up, and everybody's looking, you know, they're all looking at me, you know, must be a new guy, you know. I have to park the car against a tree because it's not a flat parking lot and there's no emergency brake or anything, so I park the car against a tree and I go inside and I sit down in the meeting, okay, and I'm toward the back, you know, that's where you go, and I'm sitting in the back and I'm like this, you know, and this woman taps me on the shoulder and goes, Here's a step book. We're reading from step 12. I go, and I look down the row, and they're coming down the row at me. Okay, I'm going to have to read a paragraph out of this book. And I panic. Okay, I get up and I leave. And I'm standing outside on the porch, and I'm having a cigarette, and I'm thinking, you know, I can't do this. I can't. This is too hard. This is just crazy. I'm not going to be able to deal with this. I got to read a paragraph, you know. And I don't know if I can do this. And this guy, I'll never forget, this guy named Jorge came out, and he comes up to me, and he goes, "Hi, my name's Jorge. What's your deal?" And I said something like, "Oh, this is crazy. I was a lawyer. This is all relapses and demons, and, you know, stuff. It was horrible, maggots." And he goes, "Well, how about if you come on back into the meeting with me?" And I'm like, "Oh, there's a meeting tomorrow. You know, I'm thinking about this meeting tomorrow." Now, he was smart enough to know what tomorrow means, okay? Tomorrow doesn't even, you know, tomorrow is how you get out of things today. So I'm like, no. And he goes, come on. And he grabs me, all right. You know, and he pulls me into the meeting, and the only places left are up in the second row. Now, thank God they're done with, you know, reading the paragraphs now. So I'm just sitting there, and I'm listening to somebody share. You know, and they're like, "Yeah, really?" I'm sitting here, you know, like this. And he leans over to me, and he goes, "Okay, now raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." I'm like, "Well, you know, tomorrow is this meeting tomorrow. Everybody raises their hand. Everybody's coming back, you know." And he goes, "Raise your hand." He starts getting loud, and people start looking at me because he's getting so loud. Okay, so I go into a panic. Now, I've never seen this done before, never seen it done since, but right in the middle of a woman sharing, I go, and I raise my hand, you know, and the leader of the meeting's a little confused because, you know, normally you wait until somebody's done, but he shut her up and he called on me. And I said something like this: "Oh, it's Chris, I don't know, it's a horrible relapse, it's vomiting, death terrors, there's no blood, it's horrible. And thank you." And there's a dead silence for about 5 seconds. And then all of a sudden, yay! Everybody starts cheering, yay! They're screaming, they're yelling. Now, I took it as acceptance, okay? I now know it's like, "You pathetic bastard, oh, I thought I had problems, oh, thank you, you know, I'm so glad I'm not you, you know." I mean, you know, that's what it really was. But now here's what happened, okay? There was a wall of fear, that self-centered fear of the alcoholic. It's a total lack of dealage, you know. It's an anxiety. You can't do it, you know. Raising my hand and telling everybody that I was coming back knocked that wall down to a certain degree. And I felt, for the first time in my life, I felt like maybe I'll survive this. Maybe I'll survive this alcohol thing. And I started to go to meetings like a crazy man. I mean, I became Mr. Fellowship. I got a sponsor the next day. You know, he said, "Chris, I want you to a meeting every night." You know, I became the secretary here, the treasurer over there. I was making coffee. I was driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting. I mean, I was doing it all. Everything you could. And I just immersed myself in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I really thought that's what the deal is. Get really, really busy in here. And so the weeks went by, the months went by. People were patting me on the head. "Chris, you're doing great." Pat, 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 you know. Yeah. And but there was a problem. You know that scared kindergartner? He was still inside me. I still had this emotional bondage. I was still I would still feel shame and guilt and remorse, and I would get these resentments, these burners, you know, that I'm gonna get them. You know, I would wake up in the morning and I would think, "Those bastards." You know what I mean? I mean, that's how I would wake up. And you know, I had anxiety across the board, a depression, you know. And listen, you know, when you're wandering around AA and somebody goes, "Hey, Chris, how you doing?" You know what you say? "Great. You know, doing fine." Because you don't really think that you can say, "Well, actually, I'm suicidal, and, you know, I'm thinking about buying a handgun because this is just too much for me." "How are you?" Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't do that. So I would give the stock AA answer, like, "Yeah, fine, everything's fine." But I'm dying inside, okay? Emotionally, I'm dying inside. Now, I had a friend named Radio Shack Mike, okay? Everybody had nicknames back then, and through an inventory, I figured it out. Why? Because I was nicknaming them, you know. Anyway, he hasn't worked at Radio Shack in 20 years. They still call him Radio Shack Mike. Anyway, he's one of these tape guys. He goes to the New Age bookstores, and he's got the crystals and the bumper stickers, you know, and he, all that stuff, you know what I mean? And he hands me a set of tapes one time, and they're 8 90-minute tapes. They're a Big Book Workshop. Now, I took them because I had a long ride to work, and I didn't want to insult them, but I was thinking, God, this is, what is this, you know? Who could talk this long on anything, you know? And I put it in my car, and I also was kind of hesitant because he had given me some tapes before. He had given me some affirmation tapes. Because he was all across the board in the spiritual disciplines, okay? And I remember actually trying this, putting on the affirmation tape, and it said, okay, go in front of the mirror and tell yourself you're a wonderful guy until you believe it. So I remember standing in front of the mirror and going, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. I'm an asshole! You know, I mean, you know, like throwing the tapes out, you know. What'd you give me that stuff for? You know, it's just... trying to treat alcoholism with affirmations is going to a gunfight with a penknife. Anyway, I start to listen to these tapes, and what they were an early version, like a mid '80s version of the Joe and Charlie tapes. And I start to listen to it, and what Joe and Charlie are very, very good at is they're very, very good at explaining the mechanics of the actual 12-step recovery process. They break it down so, you know, in a very Arkansasian way so you can absolutely understand it. I didn't really understand the Big Book. They gave me the Big Book in rehab, and I read it like it was the Da Vinci Code, you know, okay, done, you know, what's next? And that's not really how you have to approach the Big Book. The Big Book is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's our textbook. So that means it really should be taught to you by somebody. You don't just pick up a textbook and, okay, I got it. You know, you really need a teacher. And in our area, no one was really paying attention to the Big Book because there were 12 and 12 meetings. You couldn't shake a stick without hitting a 12 and 12 meeting. There just weren't any Big Book meetings. And, so I started to hear the information in these tapes, and it started to upset me. Because here's the message that I got loud and clear right to me. Chris, you're the Pope of the Fellowship. Okay? You're a fellowshipping fool, but you have no program. Because if you're not doing the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the AA program, you don't have an AA program. So when you go back out, you know, don't tell everybody AA didn't work because you didn't work AA. And this is the message that's coming right at me from these tapes. And I'm not happy with these people that I'm listening to. You know what I mean? This isn't how we do it in New Jersey. You know what I mean? There's a line in the chapter Working with Others that says, if you've disturbed your prospect about his alcoholism, that is all to the good. And what Joe and Charlie did was they disturbed me about my alcoholism. They basically said that I've got a terminally fatal condition that can only be addressed with a spiritual recovery program. And Alcoholics Anonymous meetings do not treat alcoholism. The 12 steps are the treatment for alcoholism. So that upset me, but sometimes the truth will haunt you. You'll be really upset at the person that tells it to you for a while. You know, that jerk, you know. But you have to come to terms with it. And I started to come to terms with these tapes a little bit. I had, you know, a bad situation that happened in my life, and it was very, very difficult for, you know, I came to a place, if anyone's had a bottom, a sober bottom, they'll know what I mean. I came to a place where I had three choices. One was put a bullet in my head and just end this horrible nightmare of a life, get drunk, and hopefully wash away the emotional pain that I'm feeling, or try to find some kind of answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I did was I went back to these tapes. And I remember taking them out, putting the tape player on, opening up the Big Book, getting a notebook, And, you know, when they went through and when they came to an exercise and an instruction, I would stop the tape. I would do the instruction. I was actually taking myself through the steps. And listen, not out of any virtue. I just didn't want to feel bad anymore. You know what I mean? And I was desperate to try anything. Now, a funny thing happened. As I started to go through these steps, as I remember going and doing my fifth step, and I remember my sponsor saying, "What's these columns for? You know, where's your story?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, I'm doing it out of the big book, and they want me to have columns, you know, so let's just get through this." And, I went through the fifth step. I went out, and I actually started to make some amends. That's a great word to use for the ninth step. Actually made direct amends. And because some people, well, have you made amends to everybody? Well, you know, if the answer isn't yes, it's usually, you know, no. So I actually went out and, you know, I went back to old bosses, you know, ex-wives, old friends. I was tracking people down, you know, using private investigators. I was really, really trying to cover every single base, you know. And as I'm doing this, I'm doing it out of a sense of desperation. As I'm doing this, I'm starting to heal the scared kindergartner. Okay, I'm starting to heal the spiritual malady that's inside my body that makes sobriety untenable. And I start to become comfortable with myself and my environment. I start to be okay where I am, doing what I'm doing with the people I'm doing it with, which was a revolutionary shift in perception for me. I started to become okay. Now, I'm sponsoring by this time because one of the first things I learned is, because I always want people to like me, is to learn how to share right. You know, you share with a little bit of, you know, humility, kind of sharing a little bit about your faults and, you know, how stupid you are sometimes so people will laugh and think you're humble. I mean, you know, I started to learn how to give good share. And the tugboat with the most steam sometimes gets the tow jobs, you know? And what happened was I started to have a bunch of people that I was sponsoring. And they were drinking on me. Okay, a lot of these guys were drinking on me, and they were making me look bad. So I didn't want to look bad, you know? So I came up with this idea. I know, I've gone to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. What I'm going to do is I'm going to bring them over to my house. And what I did myself, I'll show them kind of what I did myself. And I started bringing these guys over to my house, and we started going through the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And when there was an instruction, we would stop, and we would do that exercise, and then we would move on. You know, a textbook. What happened in my area is there was a distance that was created between the big book and the fellowship. In the early days of AA, you had a program of recovery, the 12 steps, with a support fellowship. I mean, read the history. That's really what it was. They were getting together, working the steps, and then going finding prospects to take through the steps. That was the early history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Somewhere along the line, there was a shift, and it went from a program with a support fellowship to a fellowship with a sometimes program, if you're lucky enough to find it. That's how much distance happened between the big book. I have a couple of theories about it. One is the publication of the 12 and 12. Bill Wilson used to always say, the good is sometimes the enemy of the best. And I don't think anybody predicted this, but in 1950 or 52, whenever the 12 and 12 was published, what happened was the big book meetings or the beginners meetings started to change and started to become 12 and 12 meetings. Now, 12 and 12 is a great book. I don't think anyone has captured the mind of and the behavior of the alcoholic better than Bill Wilson in the 12 and 12. He pins us to the wall. But the problem with the 12 and 12 is it says the 12 steps. And you think, okay, if I'm going to do the steps, I should go to the 12 and 12 to learn how to do the steps. But it's not an instructional book. It's experiential. It's philosophical. You know, it tells some stories. But the basic text, he never really wanted us to use the 12 and 12 as an instruction manual for the steps. Well, we didn't know that, you know, so all of a sudden 12 and 12 meetings pop up everywhere. That's one of the things that I think distanced the big book from what was happening in the fellowships. Another was the advent of the American Medical Society saying that alcoholism was a disease in 56. What did that do? That made it incumbent upon the insurance companies to pay for it. That in turn got everybody to say, hey, you can make a lot of money in treatment. Let's start a treatment center. Let's do group. And all of a sudden they just started showing up everywhere, okay? There was 5 treatment centers when I got sober within walking distance of my house. And they were charging anywhere from $13,000 to $60,000 a month to put you in group. It was a good business, okay? It's no longer that way anymore, but that's the way it was in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, all of these people are flooding out of these treatment centers. Where are they showing up? They're showing up in AA, right? How do they want the meetings to go? What do they want to do in the meeting? Group, you know? So all of a sudden you got more closed-minded discussion meetings than you can shake a stick at. So these are some things that I think distanced us from the primary objective of recovery that's laid out in the book. Now, if we have a textbook, imagine this. Imagine if you wanted a calculus experience. And you said, I'm gonna go take calculus. And you showed up in the calculus classroom without a book, and you just sat there and you shared about calculus and you listened about calculus, you know, and you know, I'm grateful for calculus, you know, and you never open up the book and you never solve any of the problems, so you can never apply that information in your life. You're just grateful for calculus. Wouldn't that be crazy? You know, wouldn't that be a waste of time? Well, that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot. Okay, a lot of people think that it's not really necessary to pay attention to the textbook. They're like the people who hang out in the calculus classroom, you know, year after year. Or they're like people who go to the airport and sit in the terminal and talk about flying. You know, wow, there's a big one going by. That's a 747. You know, that's a beaut. Well, have you ever flown? Well, no. Yeah. Why don't you get on a plane? Yeah. The same kind of thing happens, I think, in Alcoholics Anonymous study. If you want to fly, if you want to become free, the freedom is in the process of recovery. A very important thing happened, something that really caught my attention. The guys that were drinking on me, that actually came over to my house and started going through the steps, every single one of them is still sober today. This is the early 90s. Every single one of them is still sober today. Card-carrying AA members in good standing. They sponsor a lot of people, all of them, and the quality of their life is out the roof. The people who didn't get through the 12 steps, they're all gone. They're all gone. I don't know what, you know, I'm not saying they drank. Here's what I believe. I believe that in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to do enough in AA to get enough power back to be able to stay. Whether it's service work or recovery work or whatever, if you're not giving enough in AA, you're not going to get enough back to be able to stay. Look at the statistics sometimes. From your own home group, it is really, really... It's really telling when you give out 4 90-day chips and nobody has more than 10 years that's celebrating in your group, you know. There are good groups, especially around Florida. There's a lot of elders, you know. There's a lot of people that have retired and they've got 40, 50 years. It's amazing. But up north, it's very, very common for 4 or 5 people to celebrate 90 days, one person to celebrate a year, one person to celebrate 7 years, one person to celebrate 13 years, and that's it. Now, if everybody was staying, there would be 7 people celebrating 90 days, 7 people celebrating a year, 7 people celebrating 2 years, but you know that that doesn't happen. Where do they go? Is there a retirement package that nobody's told me about? You know? Can you matriculate somewhere? I don't know. I know that I need to stay close. I need to stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have an illness called alcoholism. It will kill me. It will kill me. And you know what? I'll be in too much trouble to do anything about it before I even recognize it if I get too far away from Alcoholics Anonymous. How many people have you seen, like, you know, back away from meetings, little bit at a time, all of a sudden they're gone, you haven't seen them for a year or two, all of a sudden they come back in the meeting with their hair on fire. Oh, it was awful, it was awful, it was awful! You know, I mean, how many people do you have to see that happen to get the picture that it's a good idea to stay close to this thing? You know, the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous is very, very simple. I can say it in three words. Meetings, steps, service. You know, if you stay in the three areas of the triangle, unity, recovery, service, if you stay involved in those three areas and you don't stray away from two of them and just be doing one or something, you're going to be in good shape. You're going to be in good shape. This is the only illness I can think about, the only terminal illness I can think about that where you're basically in charge of your own recovery. If you do what you're supposed to do, you'll recover from it and you'll stay sober for good and for all. You will. If you keep disciplined about the things you need to do, but that's not what happens. You know, we tend to drift away. I believe what it says in the book. It's shown its truth to me time and time again from my own experience. It says over any considerable period of time, alcoholism always gets worse. It never gets better. It doesn't say that it gets better after you get sober. It says over any considerable period of time, alcoholism always gets worse. It never gets better. I'm sober by the grace of God today, by the absolute grace of God. There's no doubt in my mind. However, my alcoholism, the physical part of my alcoholism, gets worse every year. I can guarantee you if I walked out of here and walked into a bar tonight, I would be drunk out of my mind in about 2 hours. Because that phenomenon of craving that I always got is probably three times as bad as it ever was. Because I've been away from alcohol so long. I can't tolerate alcohol at all. And the other part of the problem is I can't be sure I can keep myself away from booze on my own. I just can't be sure of that. I need your help. I need a spiritual experience. I need to be centered. I need to be working with other people. I need to be praying and meditating. There's disciplines. There's disciplines. A lot of people don't like to hear that. But there's disciplines to Alcoholics Anonymous. You look at any of the people that have been around forever and ever and ever. They are consistent with what they do. You know, and I need to do that too. I need to do that too. Listen, what is it like today? My life is extraordinary today. I went from a bad electrician working my way up. The last big job I had, not in the field I'm in now, was in 2007. I was in charge of 80 New York City schools. I went from being somebody that you wouldn't let manage your lemonade stand. You know what I mean? I went from that person to being in charge of crews and union negotiations and outside contractors and contracts and two phones and faxes and emails. It was insane. It was really an insane job, and I did a pretty good job at it. And it wasn't like I went after these promotions. They kind of fell in my lap. But what happened at the end of 2007 was a group of people. I was doing a radio show for XM and Sirius, and a group of people came to me and said, "We want you to start to do webcasts where you interview treatment professionals." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know anything about treatment. I don't even like treatment, you know." And they said, "Well, that's good. That's good. You know, you'll be asking the questions that most people, you know, would be asking. So why don't you do that?" So, in other words, I was offered an opportunity for a startup. Now, this is really significant. We're supposed to turn our will and our lives, or our thinking, our actions, over to the care of God, as we understand them. That's our third step affirmation. Now, sometimes that's only lip service. Like, I'll give you my alcoholism, but I'm keeping my sex life, you know. You know what I mean? A lot of times we give that stuff lip service. But what happened was I had to make a decision. I had to walk away from Manhattan money, you know, and I had to live on savings while I was trying to get this startup going. You know, it was a complete roll of the dice. But I knew it was the right thing to do. I trusted that God was somehow, you know, mysteriously, you know, made these situations and circumstances happen because this is what I need to be doing. I need to be helping people. You know, He's got other people that can keep the boilers running and PS 105, you know. So So I took the leap of faith, and I did this. And for the last year and a half, I've been revolving around the treatment industry at a very high level. Because I'm a media director, and I interview these people, I'm meeting like the top people, the top clinicians, the people that write the textbooks, that own the rehab chains, that work with the government. You know, and it's really, really been an extraordinary life. Friends, I've got a gazillion friends. There's just every single area of my life today is absolutely extraordinary. And it's directly proportional to the participation that I got involved with in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every single great thing that's happened in my life is a direct result of what I've learned from you all, the grace of God, and just not giving up. This is the only thing I never quit, you know. If you're new, if you're just coming back, there's a couple of things I know about you. One of them is you're in way more trouble than you think you are. You are really in trouble if you have alcoholism, and you are minimizing like you wouldn't believe, because it's an illness of minimization. It really isn't that bad, you know. You know what I mean? While you're sitting on the cot by the boiler, you know, you're thinking, well, you know, things could be a little better. Bill from last night. I mean, you know, we don't have a clear perspective on what's really going on. So that's one thing that's true about you. You're in more trouble than you think. The other thing that's true is you are not giving the processes of Alcoholics Anonymous enough credit. There are answers to everything in the spiritual world. If you start to rightly relate yourself to God, help other people, practice the steps, go to meetings, I am telling you, you can have an absolutely extraordinary life. There is so much more in AA than you're giving it credit for if you're new. So please stick around. Please stick around till the miracle happens. That's all I have. Thanks.